start with something from Achrimos and see how many things we can cover. There's a Zohar that says that whoever sheds a tear for the two sons of Aaron who died tragically, especially on Yom Kippur, when we read this parsha of Achrimos Shnei B'nei Aaron, so it's a special skula for tshuva kapara, special skula for kapara. Truthfully, I never understood that. I have enough trouble trying to cry for people I knew that died, you know, currently, let alone people I never knew and who died thousands of years ago. So how in the world, right, can anyone shed a tear for Nadav and Avihu, who died thousands of years ago and you never met them? I just find it beyond my comprehension, except one possible way of understanding it is the following, and then I'll tell you a second way. The first possible way is, there's a medrash that says the following, that there was one of the Amorayim, whenever he came to the name Nebuchadnezzar in Megillas Esther, he would curse Nebuchadnezzar. He's mentioned in Megillas Esther once, and he cursed him. Nebuchadnezzar, shochik tamya, his bones should be ground up. But when he read about Nebuchadnezzar in Sefer Yirmiyah, he didn't curse him. Because in Yirmiyah, Nebuchadnezzar was alive. And you don't curse a king, a living king. But in Megillas Esther, Nebuchadnezzar was already dead. And therefore, he could curse him. The obvious question is, when this Amora learned Yirmiyah, Nebuchadnezzar was dead for a long time. What difference does it make if he was reading about him when he was alive or not? Lamaisa, now he was dead. The answer, I think, is an obvious answer, that when a person learns Torah, he has to learn it like he's living it. And when you learn, say, for Yirmiyah, you are living together with Nebuchadnezzar. And when you learn Megillas Esther, even if you're living Megillas Esther, Nebuchadnezzar is dead. And therefore, it seems to be possible for someone to learn Torah in such a way that he mamish lives what's going on. So my question is no question. A person who learns Torah like that and hears that Nadav and Avihu died, it's not that they died thousands of years ago. He's living it now as it's happening now. Okay, they tell a joke, a story, it's a joke, of this woman who for the first time heard the story of Yosef and his brothers. And she was distraught. She came to the Rav, how could it be? How could brothers sell a brother? And she was mamish distraught over Yosef's plight. And the next year, they read it again in Shul, and this year it didn't make an impression on her. So the Rav asked her, last year you were so upset about Yosef's plight, why not this year? She said, if he could do it twice, I have no rechmanis on him.
It's a blunt joke.
It's possible to learn it like you're living it. Okay, maybe that's beyond me, but you see there is such a level. I was thinking of a different idea. Imagine, and this has relevance to the mourning of Sfiras HaOmer also, the mourning for Talmid Rabbi Akiva. The two sons of Aaron, or the four sons of Aaron, should have been the foundation of all Avoda in Klal Yisrael. They were the ones who consecrated, initiated all of the service in the Beis HaMikdash, which is the service of Tefillah included, for all time, right? Now imagine that foundation was founded because two of them died only on two sons and on Aaron HaKohen. Had they not died, then the foundation would have been four sons and Aaron HaKohen. That means that the entire foundation for all times of what it meant to have avoda to the Rabbanu Shel Olam had a different foundation. And therefore, it affected all generations. The building built on a foundation of three is much different than the quality of a building built on the foundation of five. And therefore, I'm missing something today. person who's really serious about their avodas Hashem, their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, my relationship could have been a lot more intense had the foundation for that relationship been stronger 2,000 years ago. And because of that, I'm missing something. So I'm not shedding a tear for two individuals who died. I'm shedding a tear for the result, for the implications of that, for the loss, but because of what happened then, it had what? Repercussions. That's the word. The repercussions of what I am missing today. That's an idea. Similarly, Rabbi Akiva, every generation had the one who was responsible to be the transmitter of the Torah to the next generation. I think we spoke about it last week, that the students of Rabbi Akiva were supposed to be the ones responsible to transmit the oral Torah to the next generation. That's why the five students that he had in the end were those pipelines. All of Torah Shebaal Peh, right, comes through the students of Rabbi Akiva, through Rabbi Akiva. Okay? Had there been 24,000 students that would have created that transmission, then the status of Torah Shebaal Peh today would be a lot more intense. But because there are only five students, the status is much lower, and it affects how people are able to relate to Torah Shebaal Peh. So I'm not mourning for 24,000 students who died thousands of years ago. What I'm mourning for is the repercussions of the exponential, is that the word? The repercussions of how things would have been had those 24,000 students been the foundation and not just five students. Similar to that, I think you can relate to mourning for the Holocaust. Aside from the terrible tragedy, right, but it's 70 years ago. Hard to relate to something, right? Right, yeah, a lot of Jews, and but it's already generations, two generations, whatever. It's hard. But imagine what difference, repercussion-wise, it made for us. Had those Jews survived, lived normal, had families, right? How many more Jews there would be in the world? How many more religious Jews there would have been in the world? Right, from all of that. How many Gedolim, these were great people who died who had students, and their students would have had students. We're not talking just about 6 million. We're talking about tens and tens of millions that would have been their descendants. So, it's not just, what? Right, it's not exactly, but it's not just something of the past that I'm mourning for. But that past is very much part of the present, and the present situation, who knows how much different the Jewish world would have looked like, and how more secure and strong the Jewish world would have been. Right? We don't know, can't second guess history. We don't know what it would have been. But definitely, body-wise, people-wise, there would have been a lot more Jews in the world. So that is also part of that shedding a tear for Nadav and Avihu, for the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, and I think it applies also to the repercussions of the Holocaust. Okay. Next. Says, Bezos Yavo Aaron el HaKodesh. With this, Aaron comes into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So in the Machzorim, we say on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Tshuva, Tfila, Tzedaka, Mavirim, Esro HaGzeira. Three things take away the evil decree. Tshuva, Tfila, and Tzedaka. In most Machzorim, above those words, Tshuva, Tfila, and Tzedaka, there are three other words. Above Tfila is the word call. Above Tshuva is Tzom. And above Tzedaka is Mamon. Now, something that all of those three words have in common. They have the same exact numerical value. Tzom is 136. Kol is 136, and Mammon is 136. Okay. 136 is the same numerical value as Sulam, ladder. Sulam mutzav arza v'rosho magia hashomayim. What is the ladder? Ladders that connect heaven and earth. Tshuva, tefillah, and tzedakah. Tefillah connects heaven and earth. Tzedakah is a material thing that gives you spiritual benefit. And the tshuva, right, also repentance connects heaven and earth. Those are the sulam mutzav arza. Three ladders. Okay, so that's each one is 136. If you multiply them by the three, add them together. So 3 times 136 is how much? 408. What's the gematria of Bezos? 408. Bezos, Yovo, Aron, Elakodesh. What? Zos. Zos is 408. So Bezos, Yovo, Aron, Elakodesh. With Zos, with those three things, Tshuva, Tvila, and Tzedakah, that's how Aaron's able to go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Because Klal Yisrael back him with Tshuva, Tvila, and Tzedakah. That's Bezos, with Zos. Okay. Now, one more part to this. Many people, on the other hand, recognize the effectiveness of two of these things, but forget about the third one. They're raring to give Tzedakah and to Daven. But Tshuva is not exactly part of their agenda. So they have two of the 136s, but not all three. How much is 2 times 136? 272. Which alludes to the following pasuk. Ish ba'ar lo yeda. An ignorant person doesn't know. Uksil and a fool lo yovin ezos. How much is ba'ar? Beis ayin reish is 272. A foolish person, right, who has only 272, only has tefillah and tzedakah, doesn't know Zos, he doesn't know the 408, where you include also the tshuva, misses the point. Right? Tefillah is important and tzedakah is important, but has to go together with tshuva. So, ish bar lo yeda, and ksil lo yavin is Zos. But bezos yavo aron el hakodesh, you need all three ladders of 136, which equals 408. Okay, something to think about till Yom Kippur. Next. Okay. Let's go to Parshas Kedoshim. Perhaps the most pivotal pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim is V'yohavta Riacha Kamocha, which Rabbi Akiva said is a klal gadol b'Torah, and Hillel told the Ger that is basically the Torah on one leg. And the rest is commentary. V'yohavta Riacha Kamocha. So what is that mitzvah? It sounds very nice. Love your neighbor as yourself. Okay, but is it really possible? First of all, are you really required to love your neighbor as yourself? That means if you love yourself and you go buy yourself an ice cream, then you should wake your neighbor up and buy him an ice cream too. And not just one neighbor, but all your neighbors. All Jews, right? So every time you buy an ice cream, you have to buy everybody, the whole Jewish people, an ice cream because you love your neighbor as yourself. And that's obviously ridiculous because it doesn't only apply to ice cream, it applies to everything. And we know it's not true. You come first. For instance, if you need tzedakah and somebody else needs tzedakah and you only have enough money for one, you come first. If you have a canteen of water and drink it, you'll survive through the desert. And if you share it or give it to somebody else, you'll die, or both of you will die. You drink the canteen. Chayecha kodmin, you come first. If you have an article that's getting lost, and your father, mother, Rebbe, has an article that's getting lost, right? And you can only save one of them. You save your own first. It's clear halacha. You come first. So then it's not true that you have to love somebody else as yourself. You still come first. So it's never as much as yourself. So what is this mitzvah? So some learn that it is only the negative. It's not positive. I don't have to do for other people whatever I do for myself. That's absurd. What I mean to love somebody else as I love myself means I shouldn't do to somebody else what I don't want them to do to me. It's a negative thing. It's not a positive thing. It's only negative. That's one way of learning it. Another way of learning is it has nothing to do with doing anything. It's an attitude. I should want for somebody else what I want for myself. I shouldn't forgive somebody else the same hatzlacha, the same success, the same good things that I want for myself, I should want for other people. I don't have to provide it. They should provide it for themselves. But I should want it for them. I shouldn't feel that their success is somehow on my cheshbon. But their success is my success. And I'm happy, just as much as I'm happy with my own success, I'm happy with their success. That is a second interpretation of V'ahavta Re'echa Kamocha. A third interpretation is that it is a positive thing. But it means the following. I don't have to do for somebody else what I wouldn't expect them to do for me. I don't have to go and buy somebody else a car because I want to buy a car if I wouldn't expect them to buy me a car either. Right? What I have to do is whatever I would expect someone else to do for me, I have to do for them. Not just not do for them what I would not want them to do to me, but do for them what I would expect them to do for me. And the Ksav Kabbalah gives a list of things that are included in this. It says the following. Nine things. I think it's nine. Nine things. The first one is that I would expect people to love me honestly and not to do it in a way that is deceptive. In other words, don't appear to be my friend when you're not really. I would expect that from people, to be honest. So I should therefore be somebody else's friend honestly and not deceptively. Okay? I shouldn't smile at them and in my heart have daggers.
But that implies that if you really don't like them...
You should tell them, yeah, that's what it says. Losisna. Don't hate them in your heart. In fact, the Rambam learns that the issur is only if you do it in your heart. If you go to somebody and say, I hate your guts, you're not mekayim the mitzvah v'ahavta re'echa kamocha, even though in a convoluted way you are, because this way at least I'm not two-faced. I'm telling you the truth. I don't like you. So then there's a mila in that. A few milas. One is if you hate somebody in your heart and you don't tell them, first of all, they don't know to protect themselves from you. They may tell you things that they would only tell friends, and you're their enemy. They wouldn't tell you if you're. They would protect themselves from you. Secondly, when you don't like somebody in your heart, and you don't tell them, it festers, and it gets worse and worse. Every time you see that person, you get sick or whatever. But if you go to them and say, "I hate your guts," it right away puts the pressure down. You don't hate them as much after you said that. Right? You got it out of your system. You ventilated it. That's what they call it. It's not as intense as it was if you hold it inside. What?
Vented it.
Right. You aired it out. Another thing is. They say that that's what David HaMelech said. Hashem li ba'ozroi, v'ani ere b'sonai. God should be with me, with those that help me, and I can take care of the ones that hate me. So they say, tongue in cheek, what it means is the following. Rabbanu Shalom, I can take care of the people I know that hate me. It's the people that help me, that really hate me, that you have to help me with. Right? That's the ones I need your help with. And also, the idea is that, another idea why hatred in the heart is what's prohibited, is because hatred means separation. It means that we're not united. Disunity. You hate somebody, you don't feel one with them. So we're really not one physically, we're all separate. Where are we one spiritually, in our hearts? There, the neshamas of the Jewish people are all one. So hatred really is damaging only if it's on the heart level. But on the physical level, it's not that dangerous because anyway we're separate. So therefore, it's true. Therefore, I can expect that if somebody doesn't like me, tell me you don't like me. Don't pretend that you like me and in your heart be one way and face to face something different. Be honest. Don't be a hypocrite. So that's the first thing.
Isn't that what makes a isn't that democracy?
If what?
Isn't that a democratic, civilized way of living? I mean, if we went around telling people, "I hate your guts," it would create huge.
Yeah, it depends. It depends. If you can say, "Look, I'm not overjoyed about this person, but I can bear them." So there's no reason to go and tell the person you don't like them, because then I'm giving in a little bit, right, what my feelings are, and adapting them to be friendly. That's not hypocrisy. That's to a certain degree sacrificing and adapting yourself to reality. But if you really hate somebody and you want them to think that you don't, right, that's not democracy or whatever, that's downright dangerous. Because then people really, that destroys society, because you really hate the person and you're going to deal with them. You're not going to adapt yourself to the situation. You're going to deal with them as if you hate them, but you don't want them to know. That's already what we're talking about.
One would hope that if you tell somebody, "Listen, I'm not your friend, I dislike you," is there anything I did to merit that?
Right.
In which case you can then clear up the issues.
Right. That's another reason which we didn't mention, why it's preferable to tell somebody. That's what it says. Don't hate somebody in your heart. So what should you do? Tell them you don't like them for this and this reason. That gives the person the chance to either apologize or to say you made a mistake and explain that what the reason you don't like me doesn't really apply. You made a mistake. But if I don't tell the person, they can never right the wrong. I'm always going to hate them. They're going to think I'm fine with them, and I'll never have a chance to give them a chance to either apologize or to explain. That also. That's the first thing. Second thing. I can expect people to act with respect to me, to respect me. Just as much, therefore, I have to respect other people. What is respect? Covet. Okay? Covet, the Chochmas Adam, when he speaks about honoring a parent, okay? Chai Adam, really. When he speaks about honoring a parent, he explains what covet is. Covet is feeling that someone is important. It comes from the word kaved. Kaved means heavy. In the 1960s in America, their slang was something heavy was something important. That's a heavy idea, right? He's a heavy person. Today it has different connotations and shouldn't use it, what's it called, to describe people. They will take it offense. The world changed. But then heavy had more of a
positive connotation.
Right, positive abstract connotation. You should consider your parents heavies. They're not people you just push around. They are important people, right? That's covet. Covet means I consider the thing or the person that I'm supposed to honor important. And therefore, I treat them as important people. So I can expect someone to consider me important and treat me accordingly. Yinhag bo bekovet. And therefore, to treat me as if I'm not something that's dispensable that you just push around. I'm important. In Yiddish, we say something farnemz en ort. It takes up a place. You can't just push it around. It's something that's important. So I can expect people to consider me important enough to treat me with respect. I should therefore treat other people with respect. That's the second thing. Third thing is, I would expect people to be concerned about my welfare, right? Not to pass me by in the street and say, "How are you?" and before I have a chance to answer, be four blocks down, right? They couldn't really care how I am, but that's the thing you say when you pass somebody, right? They're really concerned. How are you? What's doing with you, whatever? And wait enough time for you to respond, right? Or say, sometimes people respond and people as if they didn't hear bichlal, right? In New York, I know that if you say hello, I make it my business. The halacha is that you're supposed to say hello to everybody in the street, even a goy, right? That's so I come from a small town. I grew up in Miami, but at that time it was not, you know, big place. Right, people spoke English then, right? So I was used to, you know, greeting people in the street. Hello, good morning. I found that if you do that in New York, even to from people, they right away hold their wallet to see if you pickpocketed them. What do you want from me, right? What do you want from me? Why are you saying hello? But that is what's it called? That's part of what I can expect other people to do. I would like people to be concerned about my welfare and inquire about my welfare. How are you? Are you okay? Whatever, right? Really, you should try it sometimes. Sometimes people do that perfunctorily. They're not even waiting for an answer. If you tell them, I tell you, no, how are you? I dropped dead yesterday. Oh, that's nice. Try it sometimes. You'll see that you get absolutely no reaction. Just, okay, that's nice. Let's go on. So that's the next thing. After that, that if you have something that is a tzara, you're going through difficult times, right? You have some kind of negative thing. You would expect somebody to commiserate with you, to feel bad for you. Right? They don't have to go out of their way to, you know, to feel miserable, but at least to commiserate. So you should commiserate with other people when they have a tzara, when they have something negative going on in their life. Another thing is to be mekabel them b'sever panim yafos, to receive people cheerfully. And here what you said is valid. It says in Pirkei Avos, the heavy mekabel is kol ha'adam b'sever panim yafos. You should receive everybody with a cheerful countenance. In other words, somebody comes, smile. Right? Now, some say b'sever panim yafos means the following. Panim yafos means a nice smile. Receive everybody with a smile. What's sever panim? Sever can mean that they think that you're happy. Okay? Even if you're not. Sometimes you see somebody and they're a real nudnik, right? And you would rather not have seen them at all, right? You'd rather that, they didn't cross your path, especially at that moment. And you can sometimes give a person the feeling that you really are not happy seeing them. Okay? Shouldn't do that. Even if you're not happy to see the person, smile. Now that seems to be false. But there, the idea is nobody's going to be hurt by that. Right? It's not that you hate the guy's guts and you're making believe you're his friend and that's a damaging, dangerous thing. What is it going to hurt anybody if the guy thinks you're happy to see him? You don't hate him. You're not going to hurt him. You're just not greatly happy to see this person. So what are you going to hurt anything if you make him think that you are happy? And just the opposite. You know what's going to happen from that? Then he is going to be happy to see you, because k'mayim panim upon him. People reflect how other people think about them. And if they think you're happy to see them, they're going to be happy to see you. And then, you know what's going to happen? It works the other way. Because they thought you were happy to see them, and they're happy to see you, it's going to reflect the other way, and you're not going to be happy to see them. So it'll work out. So in this situation, even if you're not that happy, you would expect somebody at least to not look at you and say, as if you just ruined their day by showing up, right? What is going to hurt anybody to be happy? So you'll be happy if you see somebody else. Next thing. You would expect other people to give you the benefit of the doubt in situations where there is a benefit of the doubt, and not to judge you harshly, right, and not give you the benefit of the doubt. They see you do something that's suspicious, they should give you the benefit of the doubt that you did something okay and not something not right. Okay? Therefore, you have a responsibility in loving somebody as yourself, just as much as you would expect people to give you the benefit of the doubt, you should give them the benefit of the doubt. Next. Now it comes more the positive things to do. I would expect somebody to volunteer to do something for me that I needed that didn't involve a great amount of effort. Okay? I may not be upset if I'm stuck on the side of the road, right, and I need some major help of changing a tire or something, right, if people didn't stop. because I wouldn't staff for everybody either that needed changing a tire. I don't have the time or whatever, and I wouldn't necessarily staff for everybody. Okay? So I don't have to staff for everybody either. But something minimal that I could provide without a great amount of effort. Somebody stops me for a second to ask directions, right, and I just pass them by, right? I would expect if I needed directions that they give up a few seconds of time just to point the way. I'm not asking them for anything, you know, overly great effort. So just as much as I would expect somebody else to expend time and effort for me in something that's minimal, I should expend time and effort for somebody else in something that's minimal. And that leads to the next thing. I would expect somebody to put out a small amount of money to help me, right? I should then give a small amount of money to somebody else to help them. For instance, somebody comes to me and says, this happens in New York all the time.
Yeah, I lost my money.
I was here and I just lost my wallet and I got to get back and I don't have the bus fare or whatever. Yeah. Right? So if they're asking for 50, I saw somebody, I saw somebody like that who got this about 8 times, right, within a half an hour. The same story. So it happens there all the time. This is like and they sound very sincere. And they look like, you know, but this is it's a way of making money in New York. No, I wouldn't expect somebody to give me 50 shekel to get home. Maybe 50 shekel for some people is a lot of money. I wouldn't expect everybody to. But if somebody tells me they need 5 shekel, right, because they're stuck, right, and they need, then 5 shekel, I think, is something that I can expect somebody to do for me, and I'd be upset if they didn't do it, right? It's small enough amount that I could expect somebody to do that no matter what, unless they have extenuated that. I also just lost my money. I'm doing the same thing. Therefore, I should be willing to make a small expenditure for somebody else, as much as I would expect somebody else to do for me. That's also. And the last thing he says is that a person should not be condescending to me, shouldn't be haughty and look down on me. I would expect people to treat me as an equal and not to be haughty and lord over me or whatever, and therefore I shouldn't act like that to other people. Those are the 9 things that the Ksavah Kabbalah says are included in the positive of Yohavtarecha Kamocha. Mostly it's either negative, don't do to somebody else what you don't want them to do to you. That's what Hillel told the deer. It's also attitude-wise. Want for somebody else. Don't do anything. Just be happy for somebody else for what you want for yourself. And the things that you actually have to do are only these small things that you would expect somebody else to do for you. Okay. Next. Yeah. Yes.
So what does it mean, the rest is common?
What it means is...
What? The rest is common?
Okay, yeah. What it means is the following. What it means is the following. If you can feel one with somebody, with some other human being, right? And the reason is because God created us all. Then God's also your friend. And you want to treat him the same way, right? No less than you treat a human being. And if God tells you, look, I'd like you to do this or whatever, right? He's not asking you, right, for something that's, if you were God and gave all human beings their life and whatever, you would expect them to at least reciprocate somewhat. So the whole Torah really depends on having this kind of attitude. If you can have that attitude towards a human being who's your friend, God is no less your friend, and therefore you have the same attitude towards him. That's what Rashi says.
Right, because it's not very clear. You know, people throw it around.
Right. It's not right. It doesn't mean that the rest is not important. Right. But it means that if you engender this attitude, it'll lead you to keep the entire Torah, because you'll treat God at least as good as you treat another person. But if you don't know how to treat other people, you'll probably end up mistreating God also. That's the most simple way of understanding it. Some say, so on the Pirkei Avos of Rabbi Farber, Zvi Hirsch Farber, so Rav in London, I think he was Nifter in the 1950s or whatever. So he has a Sefer on Pirkei Avos, which we're learning in Matat Yom now. So every year we pick a different Sefer. So over the last 20-something odd years, usually we had two Sfarim. So we've gone through about 40-something Sfarim in the last 20-something years. Otherwise, you keep saying the same thing over and over again. This way, every year on Chumash, we pick a different Sefer, or two Sfarim, and on Avram knows, and on Pirkei Avos, and this way we get something new every year, finish the Sefer. So that's the Sefer we're learning. He says something interesting. He says there are two ways that you can do the whole Torah, because you can't really fulfill the whole Torah, because if you're not a Kohen, you don't have certain mitzvahs, if you're not a man or a woman, or so how can you do the whole Torah? Two possibilities. One is everybody's united, and what you do counts for me, and what I do counts for you. So that's one way of what's it called, of fulfilling the whole Torah by unity. There's another way. You can learn about the things that you can't do, and learning about as if you did it. He says, that's what Hillel told the Ger. He said, I want you to tell me the Torah on one leg, right? I'm only one leg. There's all these other people there that have other kinds of mitzvahs that I can't do. How can I do the Torah on my one leg, on my unique thing, and still as if I did the whole thing? So two things. First of all, if you have to, what you don't like, don't do it, be united. If you're united, what they do counts for you. And the rest, zil gemur, go learn. Right? What you can't do because of unity, do because of learning. In those two ways, the learning and the unity, you'll end up being able to do everything.